Mike Casey is the Director of Media Preservation Services for Indiana University's Media Preservation Initiative and the co-chair of the Association for Recorded Sound Collections Technical Committee. He is the co-author of Sound Directions, Best Practices for Audio Preservation, and the creator of FACET, the Field Audio Collection Evaluation Tool. He is adjunct faculty in the School of Library and Information Science, where he teaches a class in audio preservation.
Thank you, Martha. Let me just adjust this here a little bit. And good afternoon, everybody. I'll start with just a very quick plug. Some of the technical things that will be implied by my presentation could perhaps be addressed this evening at the Technical Committee's open meeting, which is right here in this room at 7:30. So if you have questions that don't get answered, then please feel free to join us at 7:30. I'm going to talk with you about Indiana University's Media Preservation Initiative. And I will start right here. Back in 2009, as many of you know, Indiana University published the results of a media preservation survey. Well, it wasn't really a survey. It was more of a census, but we hadn't come upon the word census. It hadn't struck us then to call it that, so we called it a survey. And I've spoken about this before. I will just hit this briefly to bring us all to the same place so that we can consider what has transpired since then. We found that we have a very large problem, and I think I can characterize the problem with really just a few words or maybe one very long sentence. And that is, we have large numbers of analog audio, video, and film objects on our campus, many of them actively degrading, most of them actively degrading, carried on formats that are obsolete, many of which carry high research and instructional value, for which we believe we have a very short time window in which to do something about the problem, in which to preserve them. This report covered audio, video, and film on just the Bloomington campus of IU. It included an analysis of format degradation and obsolescence issues. Of course, we tabulated campus holdings. And I think importantly, we also spent some time taking a look at examples of items that had particularly high research value or high instructional value. We felt that was very important. So it turns out that we have over 500,000 audio, video, and film objects on our campus. This is the way they break down. Note that they're scattered across 80-some units, carried on over 50 formats, and the dimensions of the problem start to become clear. We estimate that 44% of our holdings are unique or rare. This is a rather high percentage, which I think is perhaps because our university, particularly an early president, Herman B. Wells, encouraged special collections, encouraged professors to do what they wanted to do. And so we have a lot of unique or rare materials in with these items, perhaps more than many other universities. How much time do we have to do something? We think we have a window of 15 to 20 years to digitize these items and to thereby preserve them. We're not the only ones that think this. There are many others around the world that think this as well, that this is our window of opportunity, if you will. Less, certainly less for some formats. After which, we think that the end game will be that the combination of degradation and obsolescence will make it either impossible or just simply too darn expensive to do preservation transfer work, particularly on large collections or on large holdings. That's if we start now, and I should point out that I've been using the 15 to 20 year period for about 5 years now, so I'm not sure where that leaves us. How long will it take? Well, we ran some numbers at our current pace. This was about 5 years ago. The Archives of Traditional Music calculated it would take 58 years to cover their holdings. This is one engineer doing one recording at a time for everything that the ATM holds. Now, of course, the grant funding for the ATM has ended, so there's no preservation work going on at all. Music library calculated about 120 years. We simply do not have this kind of time to get this work done. So early on, we latched upon some keywords, the idea that our efforts needed to be massive, they needed to be rapid, and I would also add the idea that they need to be considered. We're not going to throw preservation principles out the window in doing this work, and yet we have to do something on a very large scale, on a very efficient scale. So we embarked upon a planning project that lasted, well, it started out as a year-long planning project. We're now almost done with the second year. First year ran 2010-2011. It was funded by our provost, by our vice provost for research, by our IT organization, by the libraries, and by the College of Arts and Sciences. So you can see we had very high-level support from our upper administration. It resulted in the creation of a media preservation task force. We engaged a consultant, in this case it was AVPS out of New York, and we received an official charge from our provost. Again, a step that we viewed as key, getting support, enough support from that high up on campus that we actually got a charge. Of course, we wrote the charge, but don't tell anybody that. That's the way it usually goes. That first year of planning resulted in the publication of a report last fall called Meeting the Challenge of Media Preservation. Both of these reports and a lot of other information, as you'll see in a minute, are available from our website. So for this year of planning, this is the structures that we put into place. We have a working group that meets once a week and is responsible for kind of the, you can think of it as the daily and the weekly research that goes into the project like this. It's a small group, about 6 members. It reports to a larger task force that's slightly larger that includes some additional campus stakeholders. There's an even larger advisory board drawn from many parts of campus that has been convened 3 times during the course of the project. And we also had the opportunity to convene an external advisory board at the YAZA EMEA conference in Philadelphia a couple of years back. I recognize that tune. And that was extremely valuable to get international perspective and experience on this issue. And then again, our consultant, AVPS. Some of the things in the report, you can go read the report. I'll just hit a few things that I consider highlights. Articulating a set of preservation principles. You can see the areas in which we have articulated principles. Some of these, of course, are very common sense, like leverage existing resources. As you drill down a little bit deeper, though, you find that they're perhaps not quite as common sense as you first thought. It's very useful to figure out what resources you have on a campus, particularly a campus as large as ours. And you can see some of the other areas in which we have articulated principles that provide a foundation from which to make decisions in constructing a preservation program on our campus. We did the same thing with access principles in a bit less detail. Some of these are being fleshed out even as we speak in this following year. We then needed to analyze whether we were going to try to do this in-house or outsource. We did this analysis along the lines of a number of variables, including the idea of scale and uniformity, as in how much stuff do we have, how uniform is it homogeneous or heterogeneous, and how does that impact where we want to actually have the preservation transfer part done. Understanding, of course, that digitization, or as I call it, preservation transfer, is just one step in a pretty long preservation chain. There are many stages in that chain before digitization and after digitization that need to be successfully accomplished if preservation is going to be sustainable and enduring. We also analyzed quality control functions, where we wanted the future location of expertise to reside, that is within our institution or within an outside vendor. Did we have an opportunity to fulfill our institution's educational mission? Was there an opportunity for IU to assume a national leadership position? Something the administration wants to hear about and wants us to talk about. I'll talk more about this tomorrow at the technical committee session. And cost. What was it going to cost? Now, all of these variables led us to conclude that, in fact, we would be better off developing in-house capabilities, developing a media preservation center to do this work. That thinking has changed, or I might say progressed a little bit since then. More on that in just a minute. From there, we needed to think about our approach to preservation transfer. There's a number of ways to do it. There's the custom one-to-one, what we call a one-to-one workflow, preservation transfer workflow, where you have one engineer doing one recording at a time, one by one by one. There's the idea of parallel transfer, where one engineer is transferring more than one recording at a time. And around the world, there are many ways to do this as well. The idea of mass migration, the idea of mass digitization, which is similar, but depending on how you define it, perhaps a bit different, and then smaller scale approaches. It led us to a discussion of trying to understand where for us was the intersection of preservation principles and efficiency. And so we developed, which we outlined in the report, our approach. We call it the Indiana approach, at least internally, what our approach to preservation transfer would be. This is audio engineer John Dawson doing what we might consider a one-to-one transfer of an aluminum disc. And here's John doing a parallel transfer of cassettes, three on each side. Perhaps the cornerstone recommendation from this report was to develop what we call the Indiana Media Preservation and Access Center, or IMPAC for short. This is a service organization. It will provide services to the campus, audio preservation services, video preservation transfer services, film conservation and access digitization. Other services as well, some help for units with pre-digitization kinds of things, done by what we call a SMART team, that stands for Strategic Media Access Resource Team. Everybody wants to be on a SMART team, particularly graduate students, so the wording works pretty well. Originally, the idea was to call it a SWAT team, but I wasn't crazy about that. And then other things that the IMPAC will do, some of these pretty obvious, creating derivatives, quality control, many more as well. This is a visualization of the IMPAC. The central hub is really what we might consider processing. Intake, pre-digitization preparation, post-processing, that's where a lot of your time and energy and resources end up going into. Digitization can be relatively simple. Well, I say that in a very black and white way. Some of it's hard, but some of it can be relatively simple. And quality control as well. You can see the audio section up there in the top left. Each of the boxes equals, at least for this build plan, a room, video, film, born digital, and on and on. Arriving at this build plan was a data-driven process. We were helped mightily by our consultant AVPS, who constructed a very complex series of spreadsheets. You can see one piece of the spreadsheet right here. Essentially, what we're doing is we're taking information from our preservation survey on numbers of recordings in each format. We are, based on the information that we have, then generating an estimate of playback time. That's kind of the key figure. Once we have playback time, we have metrics that we can use to understand how long it's going to take to preserve recordings in any given format. So from there, we can get to how many years it will take, for example, to preserve our open reel tape collection, how many people that will take, how much staff time, how many rooms it will take for them to work in, to do it within a defined time period. Our time period is 15 years. So we set some targets. We chose the 15-year time period. This is the period of time in which we want to complete this work, and you can see the audio, video, and film targets. Even talking about building this Media Preservation and Access Center, we still have to ask ourselves, how are we going to get this done within 15 years? That is, how do we reach this idea of massive and rapid and considered? And in many ways, what I'm saying is, what are the assumptions behind the data? One assumption is that we will prioritize. We're not going to do everything. And our administration is encouraging this idea. They don't want us to do everything. They want us to make choices. So we've taken them at their word, and we're developing tools to help us make choices. Prioritization is another topic entirely that I could do an entire session on. But just briefly, I'll say that we're developing a software application to help us prioritize by preservation, condition, and risk. You may ask, why are you doing that? Don't you have FACET? We do have FACET. FACET is too narrow. FACET was developed for the archives of traditional music. It fulfills a very narrow function very well, but it can't handle such a wide campus initiative. So we're developing a new tool. You may ask, aren't there other tools out there? There are. We've looked at all of them. And obviously, we think that we're developing something that's going to meet our needs a little bit better. The tool that we're developing is called Media Score, and it's in collaboration with AVPS. So this is joint development, and it will be done this summer. It will be put into production this summer, and we'll release it to the community probably later this year. For the last couple of years, we've also been developing a kind of a parallel tool to help us analyze research and instructional value for media collections. This tool is called Media Rivers, and this is being done under the last part of the NEH Sound Directions grant, and that will also be done this year as well. Our prioritization is done with, hopefully, the full engagement of curatorial and unit staff. That's certainly what we encourage. And what we're trying to do right now is we're trying to set up the first 5 years of priorities for the impact. That's our charge at the moment. So this first round of prioritization is to get the content for the first 5 years. After that, there'll be another round of prioritization. And this work has started within the last month. It's been tool development and testing for a while, but we're now actually going out to units and starting to talk about their collections, feeding data into these tools and starting to set some priorities. Another thing that we'll need to do to reach our goals is to automate the parts of the workflow that machines can do faster and more accurately. Using a completely manual workflow is just not going to get through this stuff in an efficient manner. And you can see some of the kinds of things that automation allows you to do. Automatically embedding metadata into files, metadata entry, so forth and so on. We will also use parallel transfer workflows. We've done a little bit of research and development under Sound Directions, and what we're trying to do here is to find what we consider to be safe methods of parallel transfer for research archives. Most of the mass migration, mass digitization workflows in place, you see a lot of this in Europe, are built around broadcast archives, which are an entirely different animal than the kinds of materials that we have. So we're trying to adapt some of those techniques for research archives. And our plan is to use a mix of 1-to-1, 2-to-1, and 4-to-1 workflows. Film's a bit of a different story. One of the most important things to do for film is to control the climate. Nearly all of the campus film is now in the auxiliary library facility, which maintains 50 degrees Fahrenheit and 30% relative humidity. And this has been accomplished just within the last year. This is a huge step for us. We are also looking at film scanning technologies and working with the idea of access, and increasingly we're starting to think about it to some extent as preservation work as well. But access digitization. We have established a film archive at IU, which was just accepted into FEOF, which is a huge step for us as well. And we've also, our university administration has renovated the old university theater into a state-of-the-art projection facility that's called the IU Cinema. So there's the opportunity there to project archival film. And in fact, that opportunity has already been taken up over the course of the past year. Video is an area that we have perhaps less expertise on than audio or film on our campus. I think that's true probably in a lot of places. So we've embarked upon a collaboration with our radio television services to do a couple of pilot projects. In the last year, we have successfully tested a SAMA Solo and Digital Rapid systems. We're addressing the old, are we going to do JPEG 2000 or are we going to do uncompressed? We've had quite a bit of work towards making that decision. Is it going to be 8-bit or 10-bit? How are we going to do quality control and so forth? Heading into the second year of planning, these are some of our top priorities. We're just now beginning to explore the possibility of a public-private partnership. And this is a little bit of a departure from thinking that we have to do it all in-house. In fact, we're wondering if we can engage a private partner, bring them in, have them do a piece of what we're proposing to do. We're also exploring public-public partnerships with other universities as well. So there's a lot of possibilities here that we're just at the very beginning stages of exploring. We just came back from Europe where we're trying to learn from some of the large institutions that have done really massive amounts of digitization work. You know, INA in France will, by 2015, have digitized 1.5 million hours of audio and video. That's all of the radio and TV in their archive. That's amazing. So we're trying to learn from the kinds of things that they're doing there. The prioritization plan I've talked about is underway. Two pieces of this I'll talk about in a little bit more detail. The impact startup project and communication. So we felt that even though we've not actually built this center yet, that we needed to get some work underway, that we wanted to begin work before we had a physical location. So we're leveraging existing infrastructure and resources, specifically Sound Direction staff. Sound Direction's NEH-funded project is over. We have a staff on campus who are experienced that we want to retain, so we're putting them to work. So we have audio preservation work going on right now at the Archives of Traditional Music. We have video preservation workflow that's being set up at Radio Television Services, and we have some film work being done as well. The idea is to test some of our ideas, develop workflows, gain further experience, and also just to be able to point to some really high value items that we've preserved. Point to these and say, look what we've done in the last year. Look what else there is to do as well. We have to keep making the case. Even though we have a lot of support from the upper administration, we don't have a done deal yet. So we keep pushing to make the case. Our partners on the startup project across campus. Here's a visualization of the startup project, the impact in the middle, and audio work, video work, film work, all pointing towards developing this center. This is our film archivist, Rachel Stolce, working with a graduate student on the startup project. This is our SMART team looking smart at the Archives of Traditional Music. Audio engineer John Dawson measuring an Orson Welles lacquer disc, just the first collection that we started with. Another audio engineer, Tony Tatey, from the School of Music, measuring some cleaning fluids. And John looking through a microscope. I wish I had a photograph of Susan Huyenga, who's our collection processing manager, who's here at the conference, but she does quality control work quite a bit. It's really hard to get an exciting photo of doing QC work. So I apologize to Susan. I have no photos of her that I can show. Communication, again, because we need to keep pushing on this. We need to keep making this sell. We've come up with a communication strategy. So it's what you would expect. It's a blog, it's a website, it's a blog, it's Facebook, and it's Twitter. This is a blog where you can follow the project as it unfolds. Facebook, or even tweeting, imagine that. And then just one more thought, kind of parallel development. Our digital library program has a grant from IMLS to develop variations on video, which is to provide basic video access infrastructure, so basic video and audio, for that matter, to playback. And so this will be going on for the next 3 years. And I'll end just by returning to our targets. This is what we're trying to do. This much audio, video, and film over a 15-year period beginning next year, we hope, extending into 2027. That's our goal. Thank you very much. Questions? I'd be happy to take a few questions if there are any. Yes. The question was, are we doing anything in terms of working with manufacturers to get support and collaboration? Well, we've had some good relationships with manufacturers as part of Sound Directions in terms of buying stuff, and buying stuff for a reasonably good price, which has been great. We're not doing anything formal. I'm not sure I see a lot of potential, to be honest, in terms of the fact that we're, the archival market is a very small and niche market. I don't see us driving that. Now, some of you may disagree, and I'd love to have that conversation. Perhaps tonight would be a good time to have that conversation. But in my experience, I don't see us being able to drive that market. We end up reacting more to what commercial manufacturers want to put out onto the market and making things work within that. So that's not something we've been actively exploring, but I'd love to hear another perspective. Any other questions? Yes. Great question. The question was, I did not mention a digital repository. That's true. Our files right now are stored in the Indiana University Massive Data Storage System, which was established in the late 1990s. It was one of the first of its kind at an academic institution. Has a capacity of about, it's up to around 4 or 5 petabytes right now. It's a hard disk cache with migration to a data tape. It provides bit level preservation. That is, you put the bits in, it will give you the bits out. It does not provide what we might consider preservation services, like data integrity checking, or ways to wrap metadata and associate it with the file essences. The Digital Library Program is working on a Fedora-based preservation repository that is meant to manage the metadata associated with files in the mass storage system. That's the model that we're following. There's another initiative called DEEPEN, which is to develop distributed preservation network that our campus is participating in as well. I don't know where that's going to go. It's in a very early stage, but that's what we're doing so far. Yes?
Have you had any success trying to find alumni who would want to sponsor that kind of work? Get their name put on the building?
Yeah, that's a great question. Alumni who would like to sponsor that kind of work. Our foundation has been working along those lines. Nothing to report. I will say that I don't care what the facility is called. It doesn't have to be the Indiana Media Preservation and Access Center. That works for us for now, conceptually. But I'd love to see a nice name, whatever that name may be, on the front of that. We'll see if anything pans out, but there is work in that direction. Yeah, question?
Along those same lines, are you feeling pressure now, or are you anticipating pressure from the administration to make the center self-supporting or even a profit center? Not an issue.
We're being encouraged to think big. We've been told to think bigger than we've been thinking. There is some noise about bringing some money in. I think people realize that this is not going to be a profit-making venture. Certainly the experience of folks in Europe who have tried to monetize their content has not been very successful. I think no one has really found the key to doing that yet that I'm aware of. So, we're talking to other universities about perhaps buying into this. In return, they'll get some services, so that may generate some income. We surely will try to, for the things that we have rights to, try to make it available to people, perhaps some of it for charge for certain kinds of uses. There's a lot of talk. There's no real plan, and we're not being pressured into a plan, at least not yet. Anything else? Yeah.
What do you know now that you didn't know going into the beginning of all this that maybe was a really big eye-opener? And maybe also as well, what are you doing now that you weren't doing when you first started that you wish you might have done sooner?
That's a good question. And it depends on what part of the process we start with to be able to answer that question. With the media preservation survey, I think we were pretty happy with the way that came out. But there are certainly some things we might have done differently in terms of trying to get a better handle on playback time, on duration, which is really the key figure that you need to have to be able to go forward. You know, we got some data, we generated some data later, but I think we might have spent more time trying to estimate playback duration data. So there's that piece. I think our moving into the area of actively considering a public-private partnership is a pretty big departure. For us, it's not an area that we know very much about, or those of us on the preservation team, there are other people in the university who know much more about it. But that's a big departure and a big place where we're learning quite a bit actively right now. I'll think more about that issue, because there are certainly some other ways that I could answer that as well. Okay, thank you very much.